This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Okay, so the internet, and with it email, Google, Wikipedia, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and whatever new social media tool might have also been added to the list so far today. So now let's go back 20 years in time. If you were around then and somebody told you about all these new communication connections coming in the future, what would you have predicted about how they'd be used? Would you have expected they'd someday help the cause of freedom and democracy? Would you have predicted they'd be used to foster tyranny and disinformation? This hour, we focus on the internet and its impact on world affairs. With us, a Virginia scholar studying such things and a State Department official who's been traveling the globe promoting internet freedom. Plus, if you have thoughts to share, you'll be invited to join in, too, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The internet and democracy is our focus this hour. Got thoughts about that? You can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. To what degree do you see the internet and the social media connected to it as a force for good in the world? How much should the U.S. be involving itself in trying to promote internet freedom across the globe? Is cybersecurity an important, even crucial, issue in your mind? Are there events in the news that you've come across recently that got you wondering how much did social media have to do with that? And while here in America, we tend to think that free and open and protected speech is a good thing, do you ever worry that maybe sometimes when it comes to what goes on online, we don't do quite as good a job as we should at practicing what we preach? Just some of the questions we'll be looking to answer. And if you'd like to help, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-967-2825. Catherine Kendrick, I'm sorry already.
No worries.
Stumbled over your name. Catherine Kendrick works for the U.S. State Department as a foreign affairs officer. Her brief as a member of the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor is promoting internet freedom. And she's speaking to us from her office in Washington. Ms. Kendrick, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
And here with me in the Insight Studio, Kate Sanger, who's been researching the impact of the internet on world politics in her work as a doctoral candidate at the University of Virginia. She has also taught a course at UVA called War and Peace on the World Wide Web. Ms. Sanger, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a beautiful day in Virginia, and I'm happy to be spending it here at the radio station.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, I'm sure that you're happy to be here, and we'll let you back out in the sunshine in about an hour. But Ms. Kendrick, going to you first, if I could, I understand that you just recently got back from the Middle East, and I'm curious if you noticed anything that you thought might be related to the impact of the internet while you were there.
I did. I was actually in Cairo just last week, I guess it was, or the week before, just as the protests were starting, and I went on a trip, as I do around the world for my job, to look at free expression online and internet freedom issues in the country. And needless to say, it ended up being a timely trip and a trip where these issues really came into focus. You know, if you rewound to early 2011, you saw a lot of headlines that had to do about technology in Egypt protests, and there was a lot of talk about the promise and Twitter revolution, Facebook revolution, and the good that these technologies brought. I think Go to Egypt headlined 2 weeks ago, and we saw the opposite of the perils that come with technologies and the harmful content that can spread so quickly online. As I talk to people in Egypt, to civil society groups, to bloggers, a range of people, it's maybe not surprising that it's a more complex story. Egypt's in flux right now, and people are sort of trying out free expression, finding the challenges that come with it, and how technologies fit into the country's future. So it was a fascinating trip and one of an ongoing engagement.
That's great that you made it home safe amidst all of that clamor.
But Kate Sanger, you've been researching the impact of the internet on international politics for some time now. Is it your view that the world political situation and perhaps things like the Arab Spring are completely different than they would be if it wasn't for the impact of social media?
Well, I think that when the internet first started to become popularized and we became more aware of its role in politics, there was great optimism and perhaps hubris that the internet would change everything. If we got the internet out there, if we got America out there on the internet, we would see democracy flourish. We would see American power projected abroad. American values and interests would spread and international peace would prevail. And I think certainly the internet and social media has had a transformative impact on the way social movements are executed and on the way pro-democracy groups, anti-American groups, any really sort of movement seeks to mobilize its base and garner the attention of the world. But to say that revolutions, as we saw in the Arab Spring, and the kind of clashes that we're seeing on the streets today, would happen, would not have happened if it weren't for the internet, I think overlooks a long history of social transformation and revolution that's happened in the pre-internet era. The fact that we saw massive protests and uprisings in these exact same countries after World War II in favor of nationalism. And the fact that there's this complex interaction between established political parties and political groups and institutions that are harnessing this new technology, but it's really these actors offline that I think are doing most of the work in harnessing a new technology for established ends.
Catherine Kendrick at the U.S. State Department, I think people might be surprised to hear that somebody has the kind of job that you have in diplomacy. Now, you're stationed with the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, but your focus is promoting internet freedom around the world?
It is. I think you're right. I think people think of the State Department and they imagine a stodgy bureaucracy, and much of that is true. But we have a team of people here looking at essentially how we extend the work that the State Department's been doing for decades on protecting and promoting human rights around the world into the online world. So U.S.
And so
government,
the State Department in some ways views free expression and free access to the internet as a human right?
We wouldn't say access to the internet in terms of access to technology itself as a human right, but rather that the rights that governments have an obligation to protect in the offline world, not just free expression, but free assembly, free association, extend online. And it's when we think of the technology as changing those commitments that we get into tricky water. So I work hand in hand with my colleagues who work on traditional press freedom issues, freedom of assembly and organizing, but the fact that we're dealing with technologies does bring new challenges. It brings new people into the equation. It brings new threats. And so we have a team that's devoted specifically to internet freedom in the Human Rights Bureau, but I also work closely with my colleagues in the Economic Bureau who work with ICT companies, U.S. internet companies, and the challenges they face, because they're often hand in hand with our human rights priorities.
So you travel around the world in one way or another with a portfolio that's aimed at persuading countries to be more open with what they allow their population to do on the internet?
Yeah, that's part of how I describe it. I think first, just as context, it's important to realize that sitting in the U.S., we think of the internet as a global platform that we could access. That part of its magic is that we could access a blog post from Malaysia or a Facebook page in, you know, based in Russia, whatever you name the idea and the country it comes from. But it's important to realize that really isn't the case for many countries, many people around the world, and that your experience from, if you're sitting in Vietnam, is accessing really the Vietnamese internet, which is different from the Russian internet, which is different from the Iranian internet and the American internet. We're seeing a rise in individual governments imposing restrictions. so that, you know, there's a recent report from the Open Net Initiative, which does some of the best research on this topic, and it found that in 74 countries, a comprehensive survey, 47% of the users in those countries experience some sort of filtering or blocking of information online. So part of why we have this team is we think at the State Department, and it's not just the U.S. alone, we have a strong group of countries from every region committed to this together. We think that preserving the Internet as a really, truly global platform without the national restrictions I just mentioned is in the benefit of everyone, for human rights, for economic growth, for innovation, for education. And so it's something that the global community should be committed to working on together.
And if I could just jump in there, I think this raises two interesting points. So one, Catherine notes that the way that people in the United States experience the Internet is very different than the way people elsewhere do. And that gets to this question of the role of the Internet in the Arab Spring and in the tumult we're seeing right now. Countries have power to regulate, shut down, and deny access to the Internet in times when they think it's being used against them. So we saw, I believe, both Egypt and Iran effectively shut down the Internet for periods of time during the Arab Spring protests as an attempt to try to regain control. And yet the protests continue. It's just that the activists had to move offline. And right now, I just read that Sudan has shut down access to YouTube to try to deny citizens the ability to see the Innocence of Muslims video that's so enraged so many people in the Muslim world. So as Catherine at the State Department is working to promote Internet freedom, we also need to realize that when we're thinking about how crucial is the Internet and some of the social uprisings we've seen, it is strongly regulated by states, and activists working abroad don't necessarily use or experience the Internet in the way that people here do.
From the University of Virginia, international politics researcher Kate Sanger is one of our guests, and with us by phone from the U.S. State Department, Foreign Affairs Officer Catherine Kendrick. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you want to join the conversation as we take a look at the Internet's impact on politics around the world, 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Or you can post a question or comment on our Virginia Insight Facebook page. So here's a post from Lauren, who says, I've been curious how people in the Middle East found out about the YouTube posting of that anti-Muslim movie, the one that you were just mentioning, Kate. Of the anti-Muslim movie that sparked those riots when nobody here in the U.S. had ever heard of that film. Isn't it possible that some group like Al-Qaeda was responsible for publicizing the film, that maybe they'd been searching for this kind of propaganda for a long time, and then when they found it, they purposely timed the publicity so the riots would start on September 11th? I realize, Catherine Kendrick, at the State Department, you are not in a position where you can speculate, since you work for the State Department, but do you have anything to say in response to Lauren's question?
You know, I'd pass that one to Kate. It's such a complicated situation that others in the government are working on closely, so I think we'll wait and see as more information comes out.
So, Kate, in terms of this idea of some group that has it in for the U.S., whether it's Al-Qaeda or any other kind of organization, using social media purposefully, searching YouTube to find something that they can use as anti-American propaganda, is basically what Lauren's asking. Does that seem to you like something
right.
that's going on?
Well, I'm an academic, so I can just speculate wildly without, you know, with impunity. But I do agree with Catherine that it seems like we don't really have all the facts in yet. What I've read and what we've seen in testimony before Congress yesterday suggests that it seems like there was, at least in Libya, a sort of spontaneous and shall we say, organic uprising in the streets that perhaps an affiliate of Al-Qaeda took advantage of as a way to attack the embassy. But here we're seeing organized groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, perhaps in Egypt.
So it looks
harnessing
like there's
social
more
media.
To your answer. And what I'm going to ask you to do is to hold for about 60 seconds. while we get through this break, and we'll continue with our look at the internet and its impact on world affairs in a bit more than 1 minute. Catherine Kendrick is a foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor at the U.S. State Department. She focuses on promoting internet freedom around the world. Kate Sanger is a doctoral candidate in the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. She researches the impact of the internet on politics around the world. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So it's understandable that Catherine Kendrick, as an officer with the State Department, is not in a position where she can speculate about what may or may not be happening in the Middle East with the kind of protests that we've been seeing against this anti-Muslim film that Lauren was asking about in her question. But to you, Kate Sanger, you were saying, in essence, that it's possible that the internet does get used for such nefarious purposes?
Yes. Well, I think that for a long time we had a view that who was using the internet? Well, it was pro-American teenagers, young adults in the Middle East that wanted to wear jeans and T-shirts and use it to promote democracy. But more established groups and traditional political parties like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, it looks like, are increasingly getting very tech-savvy and using the internet for their own political purposes and to reinforce their existing political power. And so I think we're seeing an interesting interaction between traditional political networks and political institutions and this new media. And Lauren, I believe, is right that this video was on the web pretty much all summer, I think. And it took a sort of mobilization by political operatives to get this, to get people riled up about it. And especially in Libya, a recent State of the Internet report by a cloud platform provider, Akami, showed that Libya has the worst internet connectivity, or I should say the slowest internet connections of any country they surveyed in the world. So it's quite unlikely that people in Libya were getting quick and easy access to this video. It sounds like much more word of mouth was involved and not these newfangled technologies.
888-WMRA Talk is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. This comes from Mike on Facebook, who posted, "So the Arab Spring could not have happened without social media, and Occupy Wall Street could not have happened without social media. I'm curious why one movement completely reversed centuries of tyrants in power, while here in the U.S., Occupy simply faded away without accomplishing much of anything. Do you have any theories?"
That is such a great question.
This is Kate Sanger.
Hello. That is a great question, and one I hadn't actually really considered before. But Malcolm Gladwell has some really interesting writing in The New Yorker about the difference between online and offline activism, and that the kind of activism that gets things done is the kind where people engage in risky behavior and they force the powers that be to face politically risky compromises. So they slow down the economy. They put pressure on existing political elites. They mobilize widespread activism. And the Occupy movement seems to have been very well organized, and I'm no expert in it, but it seems possible to me that part of the difference is that they just didn't put adequate pressure on the powers that be, that they were fairly localized. But it does seem like the existing political parties co-opted a lot of the language of the Occupy movement, and when status quo powers co-opt revolutionary language, it tends to take some of the wind out of the sails of the sort of insurgent movements or rebellious groups.
It seems to me that what I've been hearing in the past few minutes from you, Kate Sanger, and also from you, Catherine Kendrick, is that in the U.S. we may have an inflated idea of the degree to which social media and other things connected to the internet have played a part in revolution or political protest other places in the world. So is it possible, perhaps in light of Mike's question, that one of the things that it may have been you, Kate, who was saying that you've got to give credit to the kind of of protest movements and even revolutions that have gone on in different parts of the world over the past 100 years, long before there was any influence of the internet. That maybe the internet acted as an add-on to some of the protests that were already happening in the Middle East in the Arab Spring. But the roots of dissatisfaction had already gone deep, and the willingness to protest was already fairly significant. And perhaps in the U.S., something like the Occupy movement, which seems to have been generated mostly through social media, because it was mostly an internet-sponsored event or spawned, provoked event, mm-hmm. that it may not have had the legs to go more deeply?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to criticize the organizers of the Occupy movement for not going deep enough, given that I don't know quite enough about their organizational tactics. But it does seem to me that...
But I think that's the thing. There were no organizers. As far as we know, there was lots of spontaneous communication across all different types of social media venues in the U.S. about people thinking that this was a good idea to have these protests. I don't know to the degree, and maybe Catherine Kendrick, you can talk about this, that in other places in the world, in the Middle East, for example, whether or not what appeared to be those spontaneous protests in Tahrir Square in Egypt were really spontaneous, or whether there were leaders and organizers who pushed people to do this. But one of the things it seems to me about the Occupy movement is it prided itself in not having leaders.
You know, I think looking, starting with the Middle East example, this really gets to what's at the core of our work on internet freedom, which is, as much as the title has technology in it, this is an issue that's about people, not technologies. And those technologies strengthen and amplify bonds between people for good and for ill. And I think they bring together people that otherwise wouldn't know that they shared the same grievances and concerns, and then know that they're not alone. But it does a disservice to some of the movements to characterize them from technology. I mean, my boss, Assistant Secretary Mike Posner, has said it as looking at the Syria case. Syria isn't having a Facebook revolution or a Twitter revolution. It's having Syrians are having a mass outbreak of courage, and that courage doesn't emanate from any digital device. It comes from years of grievances and knowing they're not alone.
And maybe, Catherine, I'd be curious what you think about this, but maybe here in the United States, we experience these revolutions as being Facebook or Twitter revolutions because we experience them through Facebook and Twitter. But if you're on the streets in Egypt, certainly in Syria, you don't necessarily experience these movements through your cell phone. You experience them by standing up with people in front of armored guards and speaking with one voice offline.
I think that's just right. And it gets to something you were saying earlier of the Egypt case, where after Egypt shut down the internet in early 2011, the protests actually increased in number. People went to the streets. They no longer could communicate online or via mobile technologies, and they got out on the streets in person. So that proved sort of more than anything how much the offline component still matters.
Right. And I was really interested, the internet has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, but so has Twitter, actually. And former U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Mike Feifel wrote, without Twitter, the people of Iran would not have felt empowered and confident to stand up for freedom and democracy. They did so because they knew the world was watching. And I think that gets to your point of that knowing that there are other people that share your grievances has an incredibly stimulating impact on a movement and on organizers. And I think we did see that in Occupy Wall Street, people recognizing that others were dissatisfied. But several journalists have noted that the people who were thought to be so prominent in the so-called Twitter revolution were actually tweeting from London, from New York, and from Istanbul. So mm-hmm. It can't just be happening online. It has to be this interaction And frankly, if you put all of your social organizing online, it makes it incredibly easy for the authorities to know where the protest is going to be so that they can have people ready to contain it. It makes it easy for them to identify the lead organizers so that they can put pressure on them, so that they can arrest them, and so forth. So I think if we put all of our eggs in the online basket and don't invest in traditional diplomacy, in things like Voice of America, where we can craft a stronger message, we run risk of becoming overly reliant on a technology that we don't necessarily control.
So to you who are listening, we're looking both at the internet and connected social media's impact on politics around the world, as well as closer to home. And maybe we could ask you to respond with something closer to home. For example, would Barack Obama have been elected president, do you think, without social media? How much do you think the internet-connected communication is affecting the current election cycle? Are there ways the internet could be used to improve our political discourse that you can think of to suggest? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Catherine, I'm curious, as somebody who travels all around the world working to promote internet freedom, I realize that you meet with lots of government panels and government officials, but it's my impression, Catherine, that you also spend time with everyday citizens. And I wonder if they tell you anything that's really struck you about the importance of free speech, or why they want to be able to more easily access technology like the internet.
Sure, and you're right. I think one of the things that's so interesting about this job, and so interesting just about internet freedom as an issue, is in the course of a day, I'll meet with — I'm coming from the Human Rights Bureau, and in the course of one day abroad, I'll meet with a Ministry of Communications official, a blogger, a human rights defender, and often a telecom company or an internet company in the country who's equally impacted by a government restriction as a blogger may be in their individual home. I think it varies country by country, and this gets to what I was saying. We think of the internet as a global tool, but the experience is really different depending where you are. It's a couple of things that touch on what we've been saying. One, the idea that you're part of a global community, the idea that, even perhaps more important sometimes, the realization when the internet in some countries gives you a platform for expression and connection that you didn't have before, the realization that you're not the only person who has the ideas that you had. And I'd be careful, sort of — this leads me to another thing, which is, you know, when we think of internet freedom and internet issues and the headlines that really come to the forefront, we're often looking at the case of political protesters or human rights activists. And those are, you know, my core constituency in the Human Rights Bureau at the State Department. But I think it's important to remember what a lead academic in this field, Ethan Zuckerman, has called the cute cat theory of the internet, which is that the vast majority of people online are accessing pictures, you know, videos of cute cats or material that's far from political. And what's interesting about that fact is when governments try to crack down on the internet as a platform, the cute cat watchers have an equal stake in keeping it open. So it's sort of — it's not just political, it's an economic internet, it's social internet, it's an educational internet, and a restriction you try to put on one piece of that will impact the others.
Steve in Winchester, thanks for calling in here on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Catherine Kendrick from the U.S. State Department or Kate Sanger from the University of Virginia, please.
Thank you. I think you're kind of missing the point. I think you have to look at the cost of participating in pushing the revolution through versus the payoff. The Arab Spring went all the way through because the people thought the cost was worth it. Occupy Wall Street seemed to have failed because it was inconsequential to the most of the people. But another example you had was Barack Obama's campaign using the internet. There, the cost was very small to the people, so everyone that was in favor of it got together and used it. The fact whether, you know, it's how deep it goes or whatever, I think is really inconsequential. The cost is the big thing.
Steve, I think I follow your first two points. I'm not sure about the one about the election of Barack Obama. Let me ask this question, if I could. Are you saying that you don't think social media had any impact on whether or not the president won his first term?
No, I think it did. But there, the cost was, you know, they got everyone together that thought the same, and everybody said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's vote for Barack. There, the cost was inconsequential, but it did work. But if the cost for people to vote for Barack was a chance of losing your life or something like that, it would have failed. The cost was, yes, I just need to go out and vote on election day, which is inconsequential.
So, Steve, it sounds like what you're saying, and I think it's a really important point about how the internet has been transformative, and I hope I'm not mischaracterizing your comment, is that it substantially lowers the barrier to entry to politics. So suddenly, anyone with a computer can speak about politics and have some hope that many, many people will hear them. You don't need to be invited to a radio station to be able to broadcast your viewpoint nationally and even internationally. You can blog and so forth. And parties and campaigns like President Obama's that harness that both to galvanize the opinion of voters but also to learn about their opinions so that they can craft their message in such a way that it appeals to voters, are going to have a much stronger shot than those that are slow to utilize the internet in their campaigns.
That's correct. As long as the cost for people to get into it or move along with the movement and push it is not very expensive.
I think
the value is, you know, you do more if it's more important to you, if the cost is equal to what you're going to get back.
Steve, fascinating observations. Thank you so much for sharing them.
Yeah, Steve, I think reminds me of something else that was good news in the last couple of weeks, which is that we saw internet freedom be an agenda item on both the Democratic and Republican mm-hmm. party platforms. So I feel lucky to be working on a rare bipartisan issue over here.
Although Mitt Romney this week might be, you know, cursing the internet just a little bit.
Catherine Kendrick is a foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor at the U.S. State Department. Kate Sanger, a doctoral candidate in the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics at the University of Virginia, researching the impact of the internet on world political affairs. If you want to join us, our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. We have to pause for a one-minute break, but we'll be back very soon. Kate Sanger has been fascinated by global politics since about the third grade. When she got a little older, just out of college, in fact, she worked for a time on international issues as an aide to former assistant U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderbergh. Today, Kate is finishing up a Ph.D. in international politics at the University of Virginia. Catherine Kendrick had originally intended to become a journalist. Her degree at Yale was, in fact, in international journalism. But after a time with a free speech advocacy group known as the Center for International Media Assistance, Catherine was invited to join a new kind of advocacy effort that the Obama administration had started in the U.S. State Department. Today, Catherine works as a State Department Foreign Affairs Officer focusing on internet freedoms. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Phone lines. We've got a few lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK and a couple calls coming in that should be processed and ready for us in just a few moments. So in terms of, well, actually, we have one other Facebook post here that I probably ought to mention. This is from Lawrence, who says, I don't mean to sound like an old fogey, but I think one way the internet has changed the world is that nobody writes actual letters anymore. It's all email and texting and Twitter. I sometimes wonder if a group of people who favored any one particular issue really did write letters to their congressman, that the politicians in Washington would be so shocked that they might even listen to what their constituents wanted. Kate Sanger?
Well, that question does not strike me as the question of an old fogey, but that might be because I like old-fashioned letter writing myself. But I think it also references Steve's question earlier or comment that costly action tends to have a greater impact. And so clicking like on Facebook doesn't necessarily pressure politicians into doing the things that citizens want them to do in the same way that, you know, organized protests on the mall and maybe even sending real paper letters and phone calls do. But I also think it gets to a broader question, which is really interesting, which is, has the internet enhanced the quality of democratic politics? So there's been a lot written on the impact of the internet on creating democracies where there were none in the Middle East. But there's also an interesting question about, has the internet here in the United States increased the quality of our democracy?
Well, we have a call on the line from somebody who I think is responding to my question about whether there was something closer to home related to the internet. This is Jan in Harrisonburg. Jan, you're on the air with Catherine Kendrick and Kate Sanger. Thanks for calling in.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My question is, what role did the social media play in the revolt that took place on the grounds of the university following the firing of the president?
You're talking about the University of Virginia and...
The University of Virginia.
That is a great question.
Teresa Sullivan gone and then back.
Teresa Sullivan's ouster and then reinstatement. I think that is a great example of how to use social media in conjunction with offline activism. So I was not a key organizer in the protest movements, but as a representative on the Graduate Student Council, I was a very interested observer. And I think what was so effective in the use of social media there is that school was out of session, which I suspect was no accident. And so in the absence of social media, it would have been much harder to corral people to get involved, to get back on grounds, to stand up in defense of President Sullivan. And what social media allowed the faculty senate and organizers of the sort of pro-Sullivan camp to do was to get alumni to come back to Charlottesville and to get graduate students, who are the people who stay in the summer and are notoriously bad at standing up for their university, to actually get out of the library and get on grounds and speak their voice. But I don't think that it's hitting like on Facebook that led to President Sullivan's reinstatement. I think it was the fact that social media was used to get people in front of the rotunda in massive numbers, calling the Washington Post and getting them to come down and cover the story. I think it was that interaction between online and offline that really made that a successful.
Would Teresa Sullivan have been reinstated as president if we did not have the internet?
That is a question that, as a social scientist, I am not prepared to answer. But I think that it is quite likely that the Board of Visitors would have had a much easier time changing the story and instating someone new if we hadn't been able to use social media to so quickly alert interested alumni and students who were on vacation to get back to the university and get involved.
Jan in Harrisonburg, terrific question. Thanks so much for getting us thinking.
Thank you very much for being there.
888-967-2825. If you have a theory, a question, a suggestion about the use of the internet and social media around the world and how it does or does not impact the political state of our world today. Catherine Kendrick, let me ask you there at the State Department and all the travel you do around the world, if you ever kind of get a sense that there are people who have yearnings and aspirations connected to use of the internet that strike you as different from what you see in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that's constantly what strikes me, to be honest. One thing that just recently sticks in my mind is I'm recently returning from a conference in Kenya, which was hosted by the government of Kenya. It was bringing together a collection of governments from around the world committed to working together to advance internet freedom, and also civil society groups and companies from around the world, particularly from Africa. And this is an issue that hasn't been talked about as much in Africa, and it was a fascinating few days. And often, you know, particularly in the headlines that we read in the U.S., the internet is always associated with political movements, political speech, whether that's in the Middle East or whether that's in the U.S. And what was so interesting about being in Kenya is the story there is one about development. And the government has really successfully increased internet access and made it a driver for improving the daily lives of people all over the country. So I sat in these 2 days of meetings, and at the very end, and it was, you know, everyone had insight, but at the very end, the person who stuck with me most was a high school student, the only one of her age at the conference, who piped up and said, you know, I've learned so much in these 2 days, and want to keep learning, and really was talking about education. And again, it wasn't political speech. She was just curious and wanted to stay in touch with people around the world and look outside of her particular school and city. So it just drives home to me how broad the benefits are of this technology.
Do you ever have a sense that here in the U.S. we have not only ease of access to technology, but a sense somewhat of taking our freedom in how we use it for granted?
Certainly, and I'm reminded of that every day. I meet with activists from around the world who are literally risking their lives to post a thought on a blog post or to tweet their ideas in the harshest environments. And it's really sobering, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for them. I think we do take it for granted, and what's amazing about the internet and why I care about this issue is its benefit is in being a global platform. And so the more ideas that are coming from being posted online in every country in the world, we in the U.S. will benefit and everyone abroad. So yeah, it's constantly sobering.
Do I understand, Catherine Kendrick, that Sweden has proposed a UN resolution that internet freedom would be considered a human right?
So it was actually a resolution in July that was adopted by consensus, which was...
by the entire United Nations?
By the Human Rights Council in the United
Nations.
Okay. It's a huge collection of governments, including some that have a less than positive view on the internet. It reaffirmed that the rights we have been, as governments, committed to protect in the offline world apply online as well. So not that access to the internet as a technology is a human right, but that free expression in the offline world translates online and governments are committed to protect it. It's a huge step forward in this issue worldwide, and the fact that it was adopted by so many governments speaks to how much this is really a global issue.
Catherine Kendrick is with us by phone from the U.S. State Department. Kate Sanger from the University of Virginia is here in the Insight studio. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Eric from Harrisonburg is now with us by phone. Eric, thanks for joining in. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest to comment on the idea. It seems like every time I turn around, I hear in the news about how we're being the public, U.S. citizens, I guess everybody around in the world are being surveilled through the internet by corporations and by governments. I heard last year the NSA the National Security Agency opened some giant information clearing hub And it just seems like we're being watched, and you know, information is being. Is there the possibility? I know everybody wants to say good things about the internet, but it just seems like maybe it's too centralized or too much of a possibility of the centralization of information, a threat to privacy, possibly a threat to freedom in that respect. And maybe you could talk about the dark side of the internet.
Kate Sanger.
That's a great question, Eric. There's actually a great book out there I would recommend to you called The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, which touches on many of the concerns that you've just raised. And I think there are concerns about the level of surveillance, not just by the government, but by corporations that could then be forced to give that information to the government. I believe Twitter was just forced to divulge old tweets of an Occupy Wall Street protester to the government, or else they would face a very severe fine. And so there's this constant back and forth between the government trying to assert more control and companies pushing back. But I think what's really interesting about this issue of how much people know about us online is that consumers really, in a way, brought this upon ourselves, because the tools that are used to watch us online are the same tools that make it so that when we log on to Amazon.com, it suggests movies for us to buy or books for us to read that we already are interested in. And so it's all of these filtering mechanisms that make, that tailor the internet for your individual use and convenience. So I think you're right that there is this sort of risky dark side, and there's increasing realization of that. And we need to remember that the internet is a technology that can be regulated. And this is why so many people were up in arms against the Stop Online Privacy Act that ended up not being passed by Congress. But we all need to be recognizing that the internet can be changed. The way it is now is not the way it has to be. Just like airspace could have been a common property and it became nationalized. The high seas used to be completely open. Increasingly, states are asserting control in the high seas. The internet can be regulated in different ways. And if you're concerned about the level of government intrusion, then we really need to be advocating for regulations that keep the internet free in the ways we want it to be and not an intrusion on our personal privacy and
maybe
freedom.
You could write an actual letter to your congressman. Eric, thank you so much for your call. We're close to out of time, Catherine Kendrick, and I wanted to ask you if you would speak a little bit about something that I think dates back actually to near the end of the Bush administration and has been continued in the current administration, where the U.S. government is actually involved in promoting technology to help people get past firewalls in countries where there is repression against internet free speech or even technology that would prevent people from being tracked in repressive countries where they want to blog about democracy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you raised this. This is another core part of our work at the State Department on internet freedom, and it's part that really gets to addressing the needs of the people on the front lines of these issues in repressive environments around the world. Congress, since 2008, has appropriated money to the State Department to support programs led by NGOs and sometimes individual technologists and different groups to develop tools and training to basically protect the most vulnerable people in internet repressive environments around the world who are exercising so that they can exercise their rights freely and safely online. And so that ranges from technologies that allow getting around filters to technologies that allow your mobile communications to be more secure. There's just as people are using their mobile phones in more and more creative ways, there's very little awareness of how insecure they are and the dangers you expose yourself to. So our grantees are developing things as creative as a mobile panic button where an activist, if they're being detained, could press a button to send an alert to their network and erase the
contact.
Press
a button
on
their cell phone.
Exactly.
What does that alert do?
It would send an alert to your friends that you're in danger and then delete the contacts, delete the information on your phone so that, you know, the authorities wouldn't be able to see all of your information, all of your contacts. And that was in response to a need our grantee had heard from activists on the ground in some of the toughest environments around the world. So this support for both technologies and just digital safety training and research is something that is a core part of what we support.
Kate Singer, we got 30 seconds left for you to tell us about your aspirations for where the internet and its influence on world affairs should go next.
Wow, that's a very big question. I think my greatest aspiration at this point would just be for people to take greater interest in the internet as a technology and remember that it's a medium, not a message. And if we want the internet to stay the way it is, then we have to actively lobby our politicians to keep it that way. And if we want it to be spreading internationally, then we have to be supporting the kind of efforts that Catherine's involved in at the State Department. But never forget that offline politics is crucial as well.
Our guests have been from the University of Virginia, international politics researcher Kate Singer, plus with us by phone from the U.S. State Department Foreign Affairs Officer at the Internet Freedom Desk, Catherine Kendrick. Thank you both so much for making time for us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Binkay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Chaspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find online postings of Virginia Insight by going to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about both of today's guests. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.